session number 30135, Reel 2.
So you're back down country, you're recovering from this injury.
This was in Chiangkai.
Chiangkai. And who is looking after you? Are they POW medics, or are the Japanese looking after you?
Most of this stuff that was done to me, there was just my friends. There wasn't much to do except just to sort of bathe me and that sort of thing. It did in the end, it might even have been then, I don't know, become a hospital camp. There were doctors there, and it was there that I had an operation done on my wrist. Because an amazing thing had happened. These two bones that cross over when you do this, these two.
Yes, the radius and the elbow.
Yes. Well, they had been healing themselves, and a spur of bone had grown out like that, so they couldn't...
They wouldn't twist.
Couldn't do that.
You couldn't twist your arm.
No. And I got a surgeon there whose name was Nardell, Major Nardell. He did an operation on it, and a friend of mine watched it all, and he cut that out with a little... saw blade that you could do that with.
It was, so pull it alternately.
Yes.
Yes.
And then I could twist it again. I can't twist it far now. That's as far as it'll go. But that was the only specific treatment I had in that camp. We did have a dentist there. I think you've met him, Martin, Captain Martin.
Yes. Yes.
Toothy Martin, we called him, and he had a dental. Little hut in there with everything made of bamboo, the chair, the headrest, the beaker, and he did dental work. He did quite a lot to me there. Mm-hmm. But that's the only time I think that I had any treatment for anything.
Right. Did you get malaria?
No, and I'm convinced that's why I'm here today. Most people had it, and that collusion with dysentery and starvation. They used to get this malaria about every 10 days. Mm-hmm. It just killed them. They just couldn't. And working, of course.
Yes.
And I never did. What happened, I found a blanket and I stitched it up into a sleeping bag and I put buttonholes and buttons around the top. And at night I would get in there and close it all up. And in the morning there was a gallon of water in there, of course, from perspiration. Mm-hmm. But no malaria. Oh,
that's interesting.
It kept the mozzies away.
Yes.
But again, most of these things, when people say to me, how on earth did you survive? It's quite easy. You died or you lived. There was no... nothing you could do about it. It was pure chance. You got malaria or you didn't. You got beriberi or you didn't. We were all in the same boat, all doing the same work, all eating the same stuff. And then when cholera came, you got it or you didn't. And I seem to have been one of the fellows that got out with all the best choices of everything. I didn't get malaria, I didn't get cholera. But I had all the usual beriberi and dysentery and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But that's what was killing everybody, I think, malaria and dysentery. Mm-hmm. And the fact that they had to work. I mean, I've seen people being carried, dying to work on stretchers. And they would lie there with a 3-pound hammer breaking stones till they died. And I was never in that position. I was always reasonably well for the conditions.
Yes. What about the food you had? What sort of rations were you on?
I think we got 60 grams of rice a day. And in some camps there were vegetables. If there was a buffalo that had been killed, that went in the pot. But you only knew there was one somewhere. When you've got 1,000 people and one buffalo... all you can smell is there's been meat cooked there somewhere, and in so many cases the cooks or the NCOs would eat that before we got it. You can't blame them. I mean, most of the cooks were fat men, and most of us were skeletons. And it's quite understandable to me that if you're in charge of dishing out food, you would make sure you've got some meat. I don't. I've got nothing against that. It happened.
It's human nature, really.
Yes.
Survival of the fittest.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, in one of those camps, Colonel Toosey was there. I forget which one it was. He got split peas in. I think that's what they were. We called them Kai Chang Iju, which was the Javanese name for it. But to me, they looked like split peas, and they were full of vitamins. And he arranged that this would be boiled up, bought to start with. The officers had to pay some of their pay into a fund for the hospital. Here again, Colonel Toosey. When the Japanese decided that they would pay the officers, certainly not what they should have paid them, but they got a fair whack, Colonel Toosey said, right, you have a third of it, two-thirds goes into the hospital. And they didn't like that at all. I must say a lot of officers had a very easy time of it. You've only got to look at the percentages of officers who died, 20% I think. And they used to sit around it. They would give themselves in-camp jobs. And it was nothing to see them sitting around playing chess and that sort of thing. And buying stuff to eat. And it was Colonel Toosey that said, no. You've got to give money to the fellows who need it. And these split peas were one of it. And they used to come, I think we had to pay for it, 5 cents for a mugful of it. It was virtually lentil soup, if you think of it that way. And that came round, and you a day's pay would get you a mug of that. But it was worth 10,000 times that. And one fellow I remember, Corporal Pierpoint, he being a corporal, was one of the people who came round with it in a 4-5 gallon drum and dished it out. But he also thought, well, I can make some money out of this. And when it was half empty, he would top it up with water again, so that he was getting money for nothing. That was one of the rackets that went on. But nevertheless, it was a very good thing. Anything with vitamins in that we could lay our hands on, we did. But once you were in a camp where Colonel Toosey was, you knew that things were going to be all right, as right as they could be anyway, put it that way.
So this sort of ruse that Corporal Pierpoint indulged in, would that have been rumbled? Would he have been...
Yes, he got...
would he have been in trouble for that?
Yes, he did. He got broken down to nothing. What else happened, I don't know.
How do you mean broken down to nothing?
Being brought down to private instead of corporal.
So stripped of his rank?
Straight away, yes.
Yes.
But that was nothing. I mean, we weren't allowed to have rank anyway. The Japanese, first thing they did when they took us was to make us take off all regimental signs and all badges of rank. So they didn't know whether they got a major or a private, or whether it was at Cambridge's or from... So they were just bodies of men.
So how did that affect the men in terms of discipline? You've mentioned Colonel Toosey and his influence, but if he wasn't in camp, how did things run? Were there good other senior British officers, or were there Australian officers? Was this...
Not really. I think some of the officers who were up country working on the railway, there were few and far between. I don't think they did anything other than work like we were. They were working, they were just men. Yeah. Who ran the upcountry camps, I don't know. Whether the NCOs... We had a few Malay States Volunteer Force, old boys, you know, planters, and they were always given in-camp jobs because poor old things... There was nothing they could do like us. And they used to more or less run the camp. But I was never in a camp where there was any disciplinary problems, whatever. Everybody behaved exactly as they would have done in a barracks in England. I don't know how it happened, but it did. There was never any trouble like that.
And were you with other nationalities?
Oh, yes.
Country?
Dutch and Australians. I used to keep away from the Australians if I could. Very dangerous. Oh, heavens, yes. I mean, if you got caught stealing a potato, you were lucky to be left alive.
By the Australians?
No, by the Japs. But if you're an Australian, you stole a lorry, you drove it into the Jap stores and took two sacks of potatoes and drove out again, and the Japs assumed you were on a working party. Well, I kept well away from that sort of stuff. They were real brigands, you know. They would be beholden to nobody. And as far as they could, they just carried on. And instead, some of our fellows would group themselves together in five or six and throw your lot in together. And if you've got a piece of bread, then you would share it among the other five. And if someone from that group would be sent up country or to Japan or somewhere, you had to go with them. You were all together, threw your lot in. And the Australians, they were in bunches of 30s and 40s. I just kept out of their way. I tried always to get on Dutch working parties because I'm a linguist. I love languages. And I thought, well, here's an opportunity to learn Dutch. So I did that. Mm-hmm. The Dutch there, again, they weren't very popular because what happened when the Java fell, the Japanese told them to go home and stay there and we'll come for you when we want you. So they liquidated all their assets, and when they arrived to us, who by now were still skeletons and no hair or anything, they turned up in uniforms, peaked caps, and money, cigarettes, blankets, suitcases. And a lot of our fellows, ignorant they were, they thought they were a German regiment arriving at Singapore, because they marched in with their green uniforms, caps, breeches, boots, and, you know, op de plaats, they were doing all this sort of thing. And a lot of fellows thought the Blinking Jerrys were here. I knew they were Dutch. In fact, one of them was a friend of mine I knew when I was 14 here, turned up. And so they weren't very popular because they had money. Mm-hmm. They could buy themselves food and make things. And also, the Dutch, as I think, are like the Americans. There are two sorts, the very nice, kind people or the arrogant ones. And you'd have both of those, and that could cause strife. Mm-hmm. And I don't know who arranged it, whether it was the Japanese or us, but quite often they had the Dutch in one camp and the British and Australians in another. But in certainly in Chiang Kai and Ubon, one or two other camps I was in, we were all together, Dutch and English. Mm-hmm. We all got on quite well. But all in the same boat. The only difference was that the Dutch could cope a bit better. They had the wherewithal to buy a few things.
Yes. You mentioned about the Australians being brigands. How did the Japanese deal with this? I mean, did they let them get away with it, or did they come down very hard on them?
Well, the thing is that, to be truthful, we didn't see a lot of Japanese. The Japanese told us to run our own administration. This is what we want. We want numbers of people every day. We want a roll call every day. And you can distribute the money, the pay, and the food. And the only Japs you saw, really, were the odd guard when they were guarding you working, which quite often was Korean anyway. The Koreans were far worse than the Japs ever were. I found that with the Japanese, if they told you to do something and you did it, that was it. No trouble. The Koreans, any chance they could think of bashing you, they would. But the Japanese, we would only see mostly at the end of the day when they were having a parade, we could see them getting on with that. But they weren't all over the place. We administered all our jobs ourselves. The Japs would say, right, 50 men, do that. And our people would find the 50 men, except on the occasion when they took five out to be shot, and I was one of those.
Now, can you tell me about that?
Right, it should come at the end of the story. But one day, they decided to shoot five people. For no reason at all, and they just said, you, and I was one of them, and they took us off in a lorry, unheard of, because we always had to walk everywhere, barefooted, and they took us to the jungle, and they lined us up against some trees, five of us, no blindfold or anything, and they got a Vickers machine gun out, put it on a tripod and aimed at us, and we stood there waiting for those bullets to come for 10 minutes. You would have heard my knees knocking from here. I've never been so frightened. Then they thought better of it. They put the gun away. They put us in the lorry. They took us back to the camp. And there we found the war had been over for 3 days.
Really?
So I could have been done in, having survived all of it. And that was entirely off their own bat. No one had done anything wrong.
No.
They just decided to do in five of us. And my reasoning of it is this. They knew the war was over, we didn't. And they knew that we were going to be told that night. Now what I think is that they assumed, well, as soon as those prisoners know it's all over, they're going to hang a lot of us. Which is what they would have done. And we had orders that it was going to be none of that nonsense anyway. But I think the Japs then said, well, we're going to be dead tonight, let's shoot a few with us, take some. And off their own bat, they took us out and did it. And while they were there, they were talking amongst themselves. And I think they then must have said, well, look, supposing they don't hang us tonight, they will when they see what we've done here. That's the way I think it must have happened. I knew one of them there by name. I wished I could have understood Japanese. That's the first thing I made up my mind. I was going to learn Japanese at the first opportunity, which is what I did in the end. I learned it at night classes.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's what it was. They thought they were going to get done in, so they'd take some of us. And then they thought, well, what if? And so they took us back.
What a lucky escape.
The luck that I've had, the escapes that I've got a photo which I'll show you later.
Let's just have a